Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you?
I am well, but I think overall it's another tough week to be a human being.
Oh yeah, why is that?
Considering what happened in Gilroy, and just another story of another mass shooting, of another devastation to being a culture. I guess I may be fine, but as a member of the human race, as a member of this country, I am hurting. And I recognize it. I don't know if you feel the same way, but at some point, your capacity to feel starts to become stretched. You know that there is so many things that are pulling at your empathy and your sympathy and your heart, you know, from families being divided at the border and mass shootings and people going without meals. And, you know, it goes on and on, that it's some point you reach your mass capacity to feel. And then it becomes really challenging to be human, because we don't have to, but the challenge is to not go numb, right? To not go numb when you hear the story, to still be able to bring up those feelings of sadness and hurt for the families who are grieving and have lost loved ones, and for what this means for the community of Gilroy and what this means for us as a people. The challenge is to not go numb, because even though I do this for a living, it feels very tempting to just push it aside and go forward with something less upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the middle of summer, so you usually equate summer with the sunshine and joy and good feelings and kids out in this, you know, world, splashing in the ocean and splashing in the lakes. And so it's even more challenging, I think, to bring up that sense of heaviness and sadness and grief around yet another tragedy. And then do we keep bringing up that level of sadness and grief and remorse over and over again until it just doesn't mean anything anymore? Or do we get to a point when we just say, that's just the way it is, that's just the way it's going to be, and so it's just another week? I don't know. I'm grappling with those feelings, and it ties in well with kind of the topic for today. Because when you look at cultures around the world, and you know they try to rank the quality of life in different societies, or the happiness quotient in different societies, or you know, the quality of life for the society, not just the humans, but also for the natural resources and the animals of that society. When they rank these things, what is an overarching theme is that you can tell the health of a country by how they treat those who cannot care for themselves, those who are most vulnerable, children, the elderly, the disabled. And when you have a country who continuously overlooks, denies, pushes aside, ignores the needs of those who are most vulnerable, you see a society that has lost its true north. You find yourself in a society that now is all about every person getting their own, and everyone else being the enemy or a hindrance to our well-being. We lose that idea, that truth, that when the least powerful in society can live a life worth living, everyone in society benefits. And when we lost that, you know, we had that vision when we put into place the protections to create a middle class in this culture, you know, however you may feel about these things, but the union protected workers and different agencies protecting the health and well-being of people for their food and their water and their air. And when we put in protections to make sure that there was healthcare or education available to those who couldn't easily access it, we were thriving in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, we weren't, but in a lot of ways, there was this moment of hope an opportunity for everyone in society. Then we lost that. Then we walked away from it. Then it became a free-for-all where it was all about every person getting their own, or maybe just our family. I'm just going to make sure my family has what they need, that my children will get the best education. And that might mean that I have to make sure other people and other children don't get what they need because I need my stuff. And that's where I see us right now. That we've become a country that does not treat its most vulnerable citizens well. And as a result, we continue to get into trouble emotionally, socially, economically, politically. And so I wanted to focus today's story on something positive, because to avoid the going numb part, to avoid that response of, I can't hear any more bad news, I can't listen to one more sad story, I can't have my heart broken again seeing a child who's lost their life, I'm just going to tune it out. To avoid going numb, you have to be able to still find little nuggets every day, nuggets of hope and love and joy. They may not take up your whole day, but they could be just a bit of your day, enough to keep you from going numb. So here's a few things I've done in the last week to help me avoid going numb. I went to see Chicago last week at Vina Robles, and that was fun. And I went with a friend who I love having conversations with, and we enjoyed the music. I think I've told you before that Chicago was the very first concert I ever saw when I was 12 years old. My mom took my brother and I and some friends. And so their music just brings me to a place of sheer joy. It was a wonderful night. And then I spent the weekend camping up at Camp Natoma with my daughter and my granddaughter and my nieces up there, and just the whole atmosphere of this camp and 100 kids of all different backgrounds and opportunities and personalities and size and shapes all together having a great time. The playing field is level. No one talks about where they come from. They're just kids outdoors having fun. I came home filled. And then I ran into my friend Laura, who is my hero, and she reminded me that we had a conversation about a year and a half or so ago about her experience raising her son, Sean, and his challenges and his disabilities, and how she found herself having to navigate all of the different services that are available in the community, but don't all kind of come together in one place to help any individual or family help their disabled family members. And that Laura managed to work through this system and help launch her son, Sean, to a life that he's thriving in. And then she looked around and thought, well, what do I do with all of this knowledge that I have? I want other families who have a family member who needs help to know what I know. And so she went ahead and started a nonprofit called Independent Living Navigator. And so today, we are not going to go numb. We're going to talk to Laura about this year and a half of building this nonprofit, of sharing her love and her knowledge, and how this little nugget of joy that she brings to the world has changed the lives of over 43 families in just 1 year. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you'll be invited to be part of the conversation as well. When we open up the phone lines, our number is 805-781-3875. You can also follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. I think we have a photo of Laura's son, Sean, holding a fish, and we'll talk more about that. You can find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can also listen to previous shows by visiting our podcast site and at kcbx.org, or subscribe to podcasts through Apple Podcasts. Go to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, our show will be uploaded, and you can listen at your convenience. But I'm glad you're here today. I'm glad my friend Laura is here today. We're going to have a wonderful conversation. We're going to waken our hearts up for a little bit, and I look forward to seeing where this goes. We'll be back in a moment to start the conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And welcome, Laura McKenzie, to the show.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth.
So Laura and I have known each other for a long time because our daughters, Molly and Kelly, grew up together doing Destination Imagination and just hanging out. And so we've known each other as kind of that mom friend thing.
Yeah, it's been wonderful.
And I had the opportunity over the 10 or 12 years that our daughters have been friends to also see you in your role as mother to your son, Sean, who is on the autism spectrum.
Yes.
How old is he now?
He's 26.
Oh my goodness. Yes. And I'd like you to talk a bit about how it was raising Sean, how you found yourself in this position of needing to find out all of the services that are available for families who have autistic or disabled children. Why don't we just start off there?
Yeah, absolutely. This has been, it's been an adventure, you know, raising a child that has special needs. And on the Central Coast 25 years ago, services were more limited, especially relating to autism. And we had to kind of reinvent the wheel in some ways to get him the supports that he needed. As we got through the school system and we got to the point where he was becoming an adult, we realized there wasn't a lot in place for him.
So through the years that he was first diagnosed and getting help for him, it wasn't until all of a sudden you realized, oh my goodness, my ability to help him is going to be limited when he becomes an adult, right? That changes everything.
It does, also because there are so many fewer supports for adults. And it was difficult even as a child, you know, getting connected with services and things. And we piloted some programs, you know, through the school district. So we've kind of been on the cutting edge in some ways of some of these supports. But again, as he became an adult, we realized there was really not much out there. There were group homes we could put him in. There were supports through the regional center to get some supports in the home. But we thought, how do we make a life for him that's sustainable and that he buys into, that's purposeful and enjoyable for him, and that is stable? We didn't want him to end up in a long-term institutional setting. We didn't want him to end up homeless. You know, how do we get the supports he needs so that he can live independently, even beyond the point where we, you know, even when we're not here? And that was a big concern. And what we found is as we tried different ways of supporting him, we found kind of this magical formula that seemed to work for him. And it was, you know, we found housing for him. We couldn't get a Section 8 voucher. He's still 6 years later trying to get on the waiting list for Section 8, so we realized that wasn't an option. So we continued to try to get that, but we found another way to get housing for him. We got him an apartment near us. We got him in-home supports through the state, and then some supports through the regional center. He's a regional center client. We found him some purposeful activity. He's very independent-minded and refused to participate in day programs. So we were able to find he loves fishing. We were able to find out at Port San Luis the Patriot Sport Fishing took him in as a volunteer, and he loves being there every day and participating in the fishing community out there. It's his place. It's where he belongs. And I'll tell you, that turned everything around.
Well, and let's talk about that, because it wasn't just magically one day you discovered, oh, Sean likes fishing. I mean, this started when he was young. Yeah. How old was he?
He was three years old when we started fishing with him.
But it was because he had, well, and if you talk a little bit, when you got the diagnosis of autism, you were on the path of having this bright, brilliant,
yes,
functioning child. And then
he had that, it's regressive autism, where mm-hmm. they start out and things seem fine, and then they start losing their abilities. And so we started out in one whole different direction, and then things started to change, and we had to adjust, you know, that we thought we were heading, Anyway, there are stories about that, you think you're going to England, and you end up in France, you know, and you have to kind of adjust your path there.
Right, your expectations.
Yes. And then how are you going to, you know, in a practical way, you know, now what do we need to do to support him? And we weren't even sure what he was capable, you know, in terms of how independently can he live? What right. things will he be able to do? But we knew one thing, Sean loved to fish.
Okay.
And we incorporated that into everything. You know, if he had to write a report at school, we'd try and get him to do it about fishing or, you know, something that he engaged him and brought him out of his world of autism and into the real world.
And you couldn't just send him down to the pier. No. I mean, yes. This is where I came into your life. You went fishing. You became a fishing mom.
Yes, I did. Whether I wanted to or not.
Yes.
And I'm pretty good now, too.
And not just one kind of sport fishing, but you've been lake fishing, trout fishing, deep sea fishing.
Yeah, it was shore fishing, creek fishing, any kind of fishing you can do. We've done it. And it's funny because I love fishing with Sean. That is where we meet. You know, we connect. And I probably, if it was just me and I had some free time, I doubt I'd grab a fishing pole and run down to the shore. But I will fish anytime with Sean, and I love it. And he, yeah.
So as a parent, you were able to find that thing that lit him up. And
so
I think
important.
A lot of parents with children with disabilities or learning disorders, the challenge is to find that thing that lights them up.
Yeah, and then engage it completely. Just
yeah, and
give
then
yourself to it.
Give yourself over.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, when we work with parents, one of the main questions I get is, what are we doing here? What is our job? What is the role of parenting? We kind of understand the part of loving our children. We understand that we're supposed to keep them safe and protected. But we really don't talk about what is the true end goal of a parent's job. And I believe that our true end goal is to launch our children into a life of independence and autonomy. And so from the time they're three, our work is to tap into those skills and resources or to help them develop the resilience to live independently of us as parents. That's our greatest job, is to help our children find that way that they can have a meaningful life. And when your child has disabilities or autism and that becomes limited, it becomes even more of a challenge, I would think. So finding the fishing became your in.
It was. And then finding people in the community, in the fishing community, they got to know him because we were out there all the time at the pier. And then they kind of got on board with him and who he was. And so that added more people to the team, you know, and they just had a big heart. And so doing some of that networking and connecting with other people that can also be a support is really important. Not just trying to do it only yourself, you know, reaching out to the community, getting people on board and willing to, you know, let him try things, or him or her, whoever you're.
And also to be able to find a level of that defined success.
Yes, yes.
That your child is capable of, because you don't want to undershoot Sean's abilities, I would imagine, right? You didn't want to put him in a group home or institutionalize him if he had the capacity to live independently. So for a lot of parents, how do you know what your child is capable of? How do you measure that?
We did that. You know, it's trial and error, but with a lot of supports in place. You know, stand very closely as they're trying new things. And if it goes well, you can kind of slowly, you know, transition to giving them more freedom. If it's not going well, you just gently redirect, you know. And so we were very involved. And we also haven't done this alone, you know, making sure you have supports in place, that they're, you know, the psychiatrist is on board, the caseworker, the regional center, the other professionals, behaviorists, whoever you're working with, work with them as well and on these goals. Get some input from them too. What's a good way I might go about this if I'm not sure? You know, don't try and do it alone. Make sure you've got the whole team on board.
And was the school district helpful, or did you find that you had to push them to make sure your son, that Sean got the education he deserved?
We really had to push. And Sean was in an institutional setting for 5 years. And he came back when he was 15 years old. And when he came back, we ended up having to get a lawyer to fight with the school district to get him the supports that were written into his IEP. You know, it was surprising that we had to fight for those supports. We thought, well, why wouldn't you want those in place to make sure he succeeds? And so it did get a little bit contentious, but ultimately it worked out, and it was worth the fight, and he got the supports he needed to get through school. up to age 18, and he could have stayed till he was 23, and we knew that wasn't what he wanted. And so we structured these other activities and supports instead of leaving him in the school system. You know, we got him, he became a volunteer out at Port every day for a certain number of hours. That gave him structured time every day, a reason to get up and take a shower, and he got to go out and socialize down there in a very authentic environment. He got to participate in activity he was successful in, and actually has a lot of respect from the other fishermen. So it was an authentic is the real thing. I mean, it's purposeful. It gives him his dignity. So he wasn't feeling that when he was in the school system, so we were able to create that environment for him with the help of a willing community who was willing to, you know, try that experiment with us. And when we went to Patriot, we said, you know, we've got, here's Sean, you know him. He can't tie his shoes, but he can name any fish you pull out of the ocean. And is there anything he can volunteer and help you with? He just loves being out here. And they got the approval of the owners of the company, all of the captains, all of the staff that worked there, all had to be on board with this. And they all said, all right, let's give it a try. And they did. And they have helped him expand his skills and be a part of the team in a way that, for about 10 years now, in a way that makes him just feel like a regular guy. And I asked him one day, I said, you know, how would you describe yourself? And he said, well, you know, I'm not disabled. You know, I'm a regular guy that just needs a little extra support. It was perfect.
Well, and also I recall one afternoon we had a conversation, a teary conversation, because Sean had said to you, Mom, I can't picture a life I'm going to lead, and I don't know what that means. I don't know what I'll do after school. And I get teary thinking about that, because that's when you knew that you had to put all of your efforts into making sure he had a life that would be worth waking up to. Because I would imagine, even with disabilities, there is depression and there is anxiety and there is sadness. I think we tend to assume that if someone has autism or a disorder or a disability, that they don't have the emotional capacity.
And that's the truth. They have a lot of the desires for it, but not the vision of how to make that happen. And so having that vision for them and helping to kind of map out that path, you know, with them, is our job. You know, it's key as advocates and as family and friends of people. You know, that's what we really do at Independent Living Navigator. We kind of help map that out, you know, and give people that vision. And we found that this worked with Sean, you know, the housing and that purposeful activity and getting in home supports lined up and, you know, being the advocate for him. Those four things were key. And we tried that also with my brother, who has a traumatic brain injury. And we had those same things in place, and he is living successfully, independently with all of those, four key areas of support. We thought, oh, that's good. So then we tried it with someone who has schizoaffective disorder, and it worked for them. And they had been just on the verge of homelessness for about 10 years, and we were able to work with their advocate and get them secured housing with the help of their advocate, and then the purposeful activities, the supports, and it worked for her. And then, you know, and so we thought, we have a formula here that really works. And it so that's when we kind of wrote it out, like, what is it that we're doing that's working? And then I was talking to you about that, and then you said, well, let's, you know, do you want to share your story? And that was about a year and a half ago. And so began our venture here, that from this interview a year and a half ago came conversation of, well, you know, what is this going to look like? How are you going to get your message out? And your program director, Marissa Waddell, was asking me afterwards, so are you a 501c3 nonprofit, you know, this message? And I said, a 501 what? See? And I didn't know what that was. I said, what would that look like? And so I researched that, and we became, a 501c3 corporation. It's nonprofit public charity, and it was a process. And I want to take a minute to maybe bore people with this, but if you're thinking of doing something wonderful and changing the world and starting a nonprofit, there are a few things you need to know. And we started out just thinking we'd be an association. It would be simple, little articles of association. And what we found out is that would leave us with a tax liability in the state of California, and so we had to incorporate. I wouldn't have known this if it weren't for some wonderful community people in the community that had heard this show. A friend, one of your students, her mom was listening, and she called and said, how can I help you? And that was Deborah. And Deborah was key in not just cheerleading us, but getting us some real practical support on structuring a nonprofit.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to my guest and my friend, Laura McKenzie. And we're talking about kind of the genesis and the growth of the nonprofit that she founded, Independent Living Navigator. I want to talk in depth about what the nonprofit does, but I also want to focus on the fact that you had this heart for helping your son, Sean, find his way in the world. And then you had this knowledge, and then you just had this little nugget of, maybe I can do this thing. And in a world of a lot of sadness and a lot of frustration, a lot of disappointment, you've been able to stay alive in it enough to bring your heart to this work. And I think that's, for me, the overall message of the show today, is that you're just one ordinary mom who never expected to find herself in this position. And now you've created this nonprofit that's helping 43 families and growing at this point, and that all of us have the capacity to find one little thing that we can do to make the world a better place. And then in turn, it helps our mental health and well-being, because I see the look in your eyes that this, as you talk about it, there is so much love and excitement about what you're able to do, that clearly this has probably done as much for you, I think, in some ways, as it has for others.
Absolutely. I sleep better at night knowing that I'm able to do something that might help other people, that is now helping other people, that they're not going to have to be institutionalized long term. They're not going to end up homeless, and that I'm a support and a cheerleader for other people advocating, who have family members, that I'm part of the solution. And so when I see things that are really sad that are going on, I know that I'm doing something to be part of a solution to that. And that is very healing for me. And knowing I'm not the only person, that I'm not doing this alone. And I would encourage people out there to be willing to get involved in some way. We had Deborah be our cheerleader. She got us a lawyer that helped us with the articles of incorporation. Meredith was so amazing. We had Teddy, a wonderful graphic artist who created our logo and helped us. And Matt helped us with the website. And we just had all, the community just kind of coming together and being part of the solution and sharing their heart.
And feeling good about the one thing they could do.
Yes. Because
we can't fix everything.
That's right.
We'd love to invite you to be part of our conversation, 805-781-3875. If you have a comment or a question, you'd like to chat with Laura. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And our conversation today is twofold. We're talking about the birth of a new nonprofit in the area. We're talking about, how do we prevent ourselves from going numb in the face of so much sadness? How do we tap into our own resilience, our own little light inside of us? And also that third piece is parents. What is our job? If our main job is helping to launch our children to a life of autonomy, then that's a lot of work. It's more than just taking them to basketball practice or making sure they limit their screen time or exposing them to a lot of activities. It really means tapping into our own abilities to help guide our children to something that they can use to become adults. That's a lofty, lofty job. Our number is 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain. We all have sorrow. But if we are wise,
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875, and I'm talking to my guest and friend, Laura McKenzie, about the nonprofit that she founded about a year and a half ago, Independent Living Navigator. And Laura, talk about who the clients are that you serve through this nonprofit. Who do you help?
Now, we'll help, you know, people have a variety of different disabilities who we help with. People, there are people with mental health issues, strictly. We have people with autism, people who are blind, you know, just a variety of traumatic brain injuries. You know, anyone, even people who are elderly, you know, going through transitions. We, you know, anyone who's who's needing extra supports, really. We focus primarily on services for people with disabilities and some seniors, so...
And I think that the idea was that you had discovered that there was a lot of services, but the services didn't all interact with each other in one place so that you could access them, that you literally had to find them. They weren't coming to find you.
Yeah, they were all compartmentalized. So you may be talking to someone about housing. They know about housing, but they know nothing about the in-home supports, like the who's going to help you with groceries or get you to doctor's appointments. And they knew nothing about the vocational things. And it was all compartmentalized. And you had to, you may not even know where to even go to ask for the help because you don't know that even exists. And we wanted to be kind of the roadmap that can help you get to all of those different services. So we don't provide the service. We provide the roadmap to getting to the services you need. And whether it's housing, vocational stuff, in-home supports, even simple things. It's you know, anything you might need that keeps you living independently, that allows you to have as much independence as possible. We have a database of information of all kinds of contacts to different services around, free food, free adult diapers. I mean, and that sounds silly, but there are little things that you may not think about that people need that makes a difference in the quality of their life and allows them to stay living independently.
So what was one of the services that you were able to access for Sean that surprised you that it existed?
The services for Sean I was pretty familiar with. One of our other clients who is blind and has a traumatic brain injury, I was surprised that the county provided a GPS locator bracelets that they come and change the batteries and track everything. If he ever gets lost, you can just call the sheriff and they've got him. They know where he is, and that's essential. This person could not live independently without that safety piece in place, and it's a $25 a month service that could save his life. So, I mean, there's lots of little pieces to the puzzle, and everybody's puzzle looks a little different. And we have a bunch of puzzle pieces, and we can help you put your puzzle together, you know.
You grew so quickly.
Yes.
Over the course of the last year and a half, that it's almost as if you don't need... People are finding you more quickly than you need to get the word out that you exist.
Yes.
But you do hear from people through your email, right? It's independentlivingnavigator@gmail.com.
Yes, that's all one word. And navigator is O-R at the end.
Yes, independentlivingnavigator@gmail.com. Or someone can call you at 805-550-8471. So let's say I'm listening to the show and I'm a mother of a child who struggles with just do autism, similar to Sean's story. And so I call you and I say, I don't know what to do. My child's 15 years old. What are the things you will do in that moment that tearful mom?
Yes, absolutely. I would just say, you know, bless you for loving and taking good care of your son and your child. And let's talk about what kind of supports you have in place now. What kind of connections you have? Do you have regional center supports? You know, what kind of, are you having behavioral supports and things? And so I find out what they already have. And then we talk about what they're going to need as they move forward. So if we started working with a 16-year-old, and start transitioning them towards the idea of what is he going to need when he turns 18? You know, what kinds of skills, what kinds of supports will you need then? And we start talking about what else they'll need and how they can get it. So if it's housing, if it's training for independent living skills, you know, things like that, we know where to direct them to get those kinds of services.
And I would imagine that one of the things that you're not thinking about when you're working with a child who has a lot of needs is their sexuality. And also, what happens when they turn 18? There has to be some things in place, because as a parent, don't you lose?
For example, conservatorship.
Yes.
We talk to them about the how important it is to get your child conserved, so that, and that's a process that it takes a little bit of time, and you want to have it in place as quickly as possible, so that you can continue to advocate for them. You know, one of the sad things that that happens sometimes, we'll start talking with someone and we'll realize that maybe that person's not going to be a candidate for independent living. They just are don't quite have the skills or the capacity that they'll need to safely live independently. And even then, we can talk about there's different options of you know, supporting that person as well. But our primarily the people we work with, they have the capacity to live. You know, they're verbal or able to communicate in writing, texting, and they have a desire. They're motivated and want to live independently. They have an idea of what that means. So we assess. You know, is this someone we can help? We find out what kind of team they have together support-wise, and if they're missing people on the team that they could have, we direct them again towards, you know, maybe Voc Rehab, Regional Center, you know, places where they're going to be able to get additional supports.
Is housing one of your biggest challenges? Because
yes.
It seems that housing is a challenge in general,
mm-hmm.
everywhere.
Amazing.
So how do you... What luck do you have with housing with your clients?
It's very difficult to get housing. We have a variety of options. Sometimes the advocate or family member can find them an apartment, or knows landlords or people who might be willing to rent to them. So kind of creating your own housing that way. People with disabilities often are allowed to live in senior living, and so some of the senior living places have openings. So there, and a lot of people don't know that.
So
26-year-old can be living in a senior living apartment complex. The Housing Authority has rent controlled, and there's Section 8, but the waiting lists to get into these housing, any of the housing, you know, that pretty much that I just mentioned, is years. So you would put someone's name on the list, you know, several years ahead of time.
Like when they're 15
yeah,
or 16
right?
years old?
Yeah, and some of them you can't put it on until they're 18, mm-hmm. but you need to know that ahead of time. Working on independent living skills will take years. So teaching someone about shopping and laundry and how to use their phone so they can call for the help that they need or things they need, starting when they're 15, starting before that if you can. But thinking ahead to independent living and what needs to be in place. So we work with people several years, you know, before the people are ready. We have one client who was 16 and just 16 and a half when we first started working with them, and they hadn't even considered the options that we were, you know, of independent living. And we were able to, that person turned 18, we were able to, they are out of the group home they had been living in, and it's been a fairly new transition. We're kind of watching to see how it goes. Their psychiatrist, their medical doctor, social worker, tri-counties, everybody's, you know, working together and making the decisions. We don't make the decisions. We leave that to the professionals. We bring them the options, and they can decide, the team decides, is this going to be appropriate and safe? And, you know, can we support this for this student, or this child, this individual? And so we make the roadmap, but you and your team decide, you know, how you want to go about proceeding with that. But here's a person that would have been... he turned 18 and said, I'm not living in a group home anymore. He would have been homeless. But instead, got him on board with the idea of independent living and what he would need to do to be able to transition into his own, living in his own place. And he is living in his own place with his, you know, successfully for right now. And we just, it's a work in progress. But we've saved someone from being institutionalized. Woohoo!
So, but it sounds like you have concerns about, because it seems that group homes are a very popular way of helping people with disabilities to live semi-independently, that at least they're moving out of their family home. But you have some concerns about the difference between institutionalized living and group home living and independence. Talk about the three.
And a lot of it depends on the functioning level of the person that you're trying to serve. There are people who there are no other options. I mean, they really need a very protected environment, and they wouldn't be safe living out in the community. And so those people need a more of a institutional type setting. Group homes are a kind of a friendlier, more family type of an institutional setting. But it's necessary for people who don't have the capacity to live in the community safely. And then there's supported living, which is someone who lives, say, in their own apartment, but has maybe 20 or more hours a month of staffing that comes in and helps them in their living. And Sean's kind of supported living. He has about 90 hours a month of staffing supports. Someone who has less than 20 hours of support is living independently, you know, truly. So
I guess one of the challenges is figuring out who might be in group home situations mm-hmm. that actually could thrive independently.
Exactly.
It sounds like one of your concerns is that Sean might have not been able to experience as much autonomy as he's capable of if you had just said, oh, here's...
Yes.
To be able to identify.
He's exactly, you know, one of those people that without a good, strong advocate, like his family, you know, and a good team of supports, he would need to be in a setting, a group home type setting. But with the proper supports, he's been able to live now for, you know, since he was 19 and, you know, out in the community in his own apartment. And there are other people who we've had that same experience where with just getting just a few of the right supports in place, you know, that's the difference between really a purposeful, independent life versus having to be in a more restricted environment.
My guest is Laura McKenzie, and you're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be part of the conversation. And what are some of the other success stories? Or, you know, in this year and a half, you've transitioned from being a full-time teacher to now being the head of this nonprofit and also working individually with different clients. So how has that change been for you?
It was a real change, you know, going from being a colleague on a team of 28 teachers, you know, to being, you know, to just it's me and my lovely board of directors. I shout out to Carolyn, Jim, Karen, Allison, Tammy, Kathy, people I couldn't do this without. But it's a completely different kind of way of doing things. When I was working with children, the development and all that is different. It's a different projection, you know, different pathway that you're mm-hmm. going. And so working with people with disabilities and trying to help them really kind of become as self-actualized as they can and as independent as they can, there's a little bit more of a plodding pace to it in a way, you mm-hmm. know, and the outcomes are, it's almost more meaningful what I'm doing right now, because I know that the quality of life of the people we are able to help, you know, is we're changing their lives, you know, immediately, pretty significantly. It's not the development of a child, you know, but it's the quality of life for an individual who otherwise would not be able to live with the quality of life that they can. You know, we're helping them realize their whole potential, that freedom, that independence. I mean, that's keeping them engaged in life, watching someone realize that they have a choice about how things go, but they also need to get engaged and be responsible if they want to have the freedoms. I mean, it causes people to function on a whole nother level as mm-hmm. well. They take kind of control of their own life in some ways. And it's a great feeling.
So how is your life? What does your week look like now? Because you're not, you know, your daughter Molly just got married.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sean's living on his own. Yes. And you're not teaching full time. So now that this is kind of your life's work, what do your weeks look like? What does your day-to-day look like?
I work about 40 hours a week with people with disabilities, not through Independent Living Navigator. Independent Living Navigator doesn't employ anybody. We're all volunteer. But my vocation right now is working with people with disabilities. And so I do that about 40 hours a week. And I, you know, I start out in the morning and get Sean ready to go out to the pier and get him off to his day there. And then I go and work with clients and help them. And then come home, I check my emails, check for phones. I'm meeting tomorrow with one of the advocates of one of our clients who's made some really big strides and going to get caught up and I'm with her. And it's, you know, at night when the dust settles and the house is quiet, you know, I'm checking our independent living navigator at gmail.com and shooting out information, you know, maybe looking up information for people that might need specific kinds of supports. We research, you know, it's different. Everybody kind of needs something a little different depending on their situation. And so it's not really like we can just post a bunch of information. We tried that on a website and, you know, we thought, well, we can post information about housing and in-home supports and things, but people don't necessarily know what they need or what's out there. So we really have to talk to people and then we seek out the information for them. And I just electronically, you know, email it to them and, or talk to them on the phone about it. And it's very individualized for each person. So I spend time, you know, searching the internet sometimes too for those specific supports or things. We even helped someone in Virginia and found that there was something called Disability Navigator in Virginia, which is doing the same thing we're doing here in California. And we would just, you know, who knew? So we're not the only ones with this idea that if you can get information to people, the information they need, it will change their lives.
You know? And how has this changed you in the last year and a half? How are you different?
I feel a sense of that I've been able to do something that's made a difference. I feel less trauma when I see somebody who is struggling. I feel like I know I have a part of a solution, you know, that I have something maybe I can help them with. Or if I can't help them specifically, I know there are other people that I'm making a difference for. And so it eases suffering in the world, which calms my heart down a bit. Mm-hmm. And it also gives me hope for Sean and for his future and other people in his situation that there are people out there, and I named a bunch of people here in our community in telling this story, that have a heart for helping people and that the world is good, you know, and that people are good and they want to help and that there's help out there.
I know, and I think that's one of the interesting things that I think we overlook is that we have a lot of services and a lot of people trying to provide services, but you're one piece of it, but you would think there would be more of a countywide effort to create a navigation system so that parents can feel like they have more control or at least opportunity to help their children, their families, because I think as a parent, feeling helpless is the worst thing. Mm-hmm. And then feeling overwhelmed with all of the possible things that you could do to help your child. And then the fear that you're going to go to situations, maybe go to a psychiatrist or a rehab center or vocation or a group home. And then you realize this wasn't the best thing for your child. And now you're trying to back up. And I mean, I would imagine there's a lot of sense of loneliness in being the provider for someone with a disability. And although we have all of these services, what we don't seem to have is an emotional net or web.
It feels really, it can be very isolating, especially mm-hmm. when you're the primary caregiver of someone who's really intensively needs care. And one of the arms of our corporation is trying to get advocates connected with other advocates and making sure that they're not alone and that they're able to kind of collaborate with other people who have similar situations, so they also know other, you know, what some of the other supports are out there. If I see someone out in the community and I recognize, you know, that they're dealing with maybe a child with autism or something like that, I'm the first one to go up to them and say, I absolutely know what you're going through. You know, my son is 26. We, you know, and he is doing great. So have hope. You know, it just give them a vision of that there's a light at the end of the tunnel of this, that things can improve and get better, and there are things that you can do that can make it better. Yeah.
So who are some of, you know, I think we talked yesterday that you've helped 43 families.
Yes.
That's a lot without having a lot of marketing.
Right. Well, and we all, you know, everybody has a somebody that they know or in their family that has someone with disabilities, and they all have questions, mm-hmm. you know, and it's amazing how many of these, we have these little information cards, you know, and I just keep them in my glove compartment because I'm always running into people that need information. And, you know, some of the people have been where we just give them one-time information. Some people we've been working with for a year and a half, you know, consistently. And so, for example, one of my brother's neighbors is blind, and his caregiver was mentioning that they lose him every now and then. And I said, oh, there's this great, you know, service where they can put GPS on him or his, you know, dog or whatever, and and they, you know, can keep track of him. And I mean, simple things like that. Sitting in the, I'll be doing something in the Social Security office, you know, for my son, and the person next to me will start talking, and they're an advocate for someone who's disabled, and they have questions about housing or about in-home supports, things, you know, and it just begins that. And so we give them the information, and we find out what their need is, and we get them the contact information to the supports that they need.
Can you list again kind of the spectrum or the range of people who can call you for services or for help? You know, we know autism.
Sure. Autism, mental health, schizoaffective disorder, you know, the people with traumatic brain injuries, people who are blind. I'm dealing with, if you're an advocate for maybe a senior who has dementia, things like that. Vets with PTSD, you know, everyone needs housing. Everyone, you know, most people with any of those disabilities need some supports, getting to doctor's appointments or things like that, groceries. Everybody needs purposeful activity. And everyone who has an advocate who's trying to support them, that advocate needs support, needs connections. So any of those people.
And what were the four? You said there are four tiers of help that seem to be,
they're essential, really.
Essential to everyone who's struggling. What are those four tiers of?
You know, housing, stable housing. That's such a big one. Having in-home supports, and a lot of people who are disabled qualify for the state-provided in-home supports that's paid for by the state. I mean, that helps with things like their daily care, their cleaning their home, getting their groceries, setting up their medications, things like that.
And we had talked about that in-home support can also be a family member, right, who can be paid by the state.
And it didn't used to be that way. So when I tell people, they say, no, it can't be. I said, well, that's changed, and now that can be. And that's really important because a lot of advocates, they struggle between trying to work and have the time to take care of their family member. And so knowing that they can get some income from in-home supports from taking care of that person helps ease that burden, that financial burden, and that schedule burden of trying to work and take care of somebody.
Right, because I think statistically 60% of all care falls on the eldest daughter in families.
I believe that.
And it's an interesting correlation that the highest rate of poverty are middle-aged elderly women who are single, because many of them left jobs because they became the caretakers. And so I want to make sure we emphasize that this state-funded support for caregivers is really important for anyone who finds himself in that space, because a lot of people, you know, don't want strangers in their home, right, but they'll have their sister or an aunt come. And so if they can get paid, then you're not setting up a whole nother level of poverty for the caregiver.
Yes. And that's, people who qualify for Medi-Cal would fall kind of into that category. And so what we do, for example, is we can direct them to where they can fill out the application, where they can, you know, and all of that. We can't fill out applications for people. We can tell them how to get in contact with those supports and get lined up with that.
So the first is housing. The second is
in-home support. Purposeful activity. And that sometimes, like what we did, we kind of had to create our own, you know, activity based on what we knew about Sean. But reach out to the community. Find a place where your family member can really engage. You know, go talk to, if they love working with animals, talk to the pet store and see if they can't volunteer there. Talk to the Woods Humane Society, see if they can't go out and volunteer there. You know, find a purposeful, really engaging place.
A reason for them to wake up in the morning.
Absolutely.
And then number four.
Advocate support. Make sure you're not alone. Make sure you're taking care of yourself as the advocate. Yeah.
So all four of these tiers has seemed to, from your experience, been the key to a lot of different areas of help. And all of this information is available through Independent Living Navigator, this nonprofit started by Laura McKenzie and surrounded by her loving support team of board of directors who kind of just arose from last year's conversation. How did they contact you? How does someone contact you for information?
So the best way is to email me at independentlivingnavigator@gmail.com. And or you can call me at 805-550-8471. And I will be happy to talk with you and see what kind of supports you may be in need of and get you the information on how to get those supports.
This is Laura McKenzie, who, instead of going numb in the face of a lot of life challenges, because I'm sure this wasn't the way you expected your life to go, has found this whole different direction and a light that, I mean, I'm sitting with you, so I see the light, but I know that you're sharing it with a lot of people, and I appreciate you coming in, sharing the story. I hope this inspires other people with a dream or a moment to either reach out to you or to share their story or to step into their own. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and you can reach me by sending an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast the show if you'd like to share this with someone. A conversation with a reluctant therapist, hit subscribe. The show will come to you. You can follow us on Instagram and also on our Facebook page. As always, I appreciate you being a part of this conversation and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
The heart is a blue. Up through the stony ground, there's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place. Someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful. Up first light and